This is Audible.
The Traveler's Gift, Seven Decisions That Determine Personal Success by Andy Andrews. This audio version is published by Oasis Audio through an agreement with Nelson Books, a division of Thomas Nelson Incorporated. The Traveler's Gift is read by Andy Andrews.
In great deed, something abides. On great fields, something stays. Forms change and pass. Bodies disappear, but spirits linger to consecrate ground for the vision place of the soul. And reverent men and women from afar, and generations that know us not, and that we know not of, shall come here to ponder and to dream, and the power of the vision shall pass into their souls. Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, born 1828, died 1914.
Chapter 1. Headlights swept the house as the taxi turned out of the driveway. David Ponder stood alone on his front lawn looking at the home where he and his wife Ellen had lived for more than 20 years. David lowered himself onto the grass. Nausea poured over him as he felt panic enter his very soul. Like a serpent easing up his spine and wrapping itself around his throat, it wasn't a quick, devastating attack, but a slow, gripping realization that life, as he knew it, was over. He was 46 years old. He had no job. He had no money. He had no purpose. A short time later, David stood in the doorway of his daughter's room. It had literally been a month since he'd seen her awake. Lately, his work schedule had been frantic. As a last-ditch effort to save his employer from takeover, he often left home before daylight and rarely returned until well after his family had gone to bed. Several times during the past few weeks, he had not come home at all. David gently placed his briefcase next to the dresser and moved toward the bed. His only child's breathing seemed loud in the quiet room. Sinking to his knees, David reached out to stroke her hair. It was so soft. The Cinderella nightlight she'd cherished since her fourth Christmas cast an angelic glow on her perfect face. Jennifer Christine Ponder. "My little Jenny," he murmured. David remembered the very moment she had been born, 12 years ago today. He glanced at the clock on the nightstand. 2:18 a.m. "Okay," he thought disgustedly. "So it was 12 years ago yesterday." A tear slipped down his cheek. "David?" It was Ellen. Moving into the room, she touched his shoulder. "I thought I heard you come in. Is everything all right?" David looked up into his wife's face. Her hair was a mess from sleeping, and of course she had on no makeup. She wore a long white T-shirt that contrasted with her medium-length dark hair. Her brown eyes were sleepy, but she was as beautiful to him as the day they had met 25 years ago. Ellen knelt beside her husband. With her fingers, she brushed the hair from his forehead. "David," she said again, "are you all right?" He took her hand in both of his, brought it to his lips, and said simply, "No." At 5 a.m., Ellen lay asleep on her side with her head on David's chest. David was on his back, wondering how she could possibly sleep. He wasn't sure if he'd ever sleep again. For almost 2 hours, he'd told Ellen everything that had happened that evening. Late that afternoon, David and a team of management personnel had gathered in the executive conference room. By 5, they had begun working the phones, feverishly soliciting stockholder support. It was a desperate, last-ditch attempt to prevent a hostile buyout by a predatory conglomerate. Final notice reached the conference room shortly before midnight. Despite their best efforts, tears, pleas, prayers, and curses, the takeover had been completed. All executive and supervisory positions at the plant were terminated, effective immediately. A security guard had entered David's office less than 15 minutes after the phone call and offered to help clean out his desk. Within the hour, David was at the guardhouse near the plant entrance, waiting for a taxi. After 23 years of service, David had been asked to relinquish the keys to his office, the key to the gym, and the key to his company car. As he lay awake, David thought about his life. He and Ellen had met the day after both graduated from Iowa State University. David had a degree in business and was determined to make his mark with a Fortune 500 company, while Ellen, with her degree in education, wanted to teach. For 2 years they dated. People often ask if they were brother and sister. David's height was their only difference. He, at 6'2", was taller than she, but the dark hair, brown eyes, and thin body type gave them a similar look. They would have been married sooner had it not been for David's insistence on finding a career job before settling down. He worked in his father's shoe store as a stopgap measure while sending out resumes all over the country. Ellen had already been teaching fifth grade for almost a year when David was accepted as a management trainee for a chemical company in Dallas. They were married almost immediately. David became immersed in his work. He felt that he had found a position that would allow him to be in control of his family's future. Ellen enjoyed teaching and taught right up until Jenny was born and then never went back. Financially, the family struggled a bit on one income, but it was a sacrifice they were willing to make to have one parent at home full-time for their daughter. "Ellen," David said as he squeezed her arm. "What, honey?" she mumbled. "Is Jenny mad at me?" "What?" Ellen asked. "Is Jenny mad because I missed her birthday?" Ellen put her arms around David. "No, honey. Jenny is fine. I'm pretty mad about it, you know. Honey? Ellen?" David sighed. Ellen had already drifted back to sleep. The world could be coming to an end, and Ellen would have no problem sleeping. He never understood how she did that. She usually laughed and said she knew he'd always take care of her. "If that's true," David thought, "how is she sleeping now? Isn't it obvious I'm failing miserably in that department?" Staring into the darkness, David remembered walking the moonlit beach on the island of St. John. Their honeymoon to the Caribbean had been a gift from her parents. Ellen's dad owned a lawn care business and had insisted on dipping into his savings for the honor of beginning his daughter's marriage in a special way. And it was special. They walked on the beach and talked for hours. At one point, David remembered, he had taken Ellen's face in his hands and said, "I promise you everything." And she had not laughed. He had been serious, and she knew it. For more than 10 years, they prayed for a child, and when Jenny came along, their lives seemed complete. David put his energy and focus into providing a home and lifestyle in which his family would prosper. But his work at the plant, while it did provide a living, never seemed to provide a life. As David told a friend one day, "I'm working so hard to live where we want to live, I don't actually get to live there." As the years passed, their savings were slowly depleted. A computer business David put together with an old fraternity brother was gone in 2 years, and rising interest rates had soured their real estate investments. Subsequently, the college fund that had been started for Jenny when she was born was used to put braces on her teeth only 6 months ago. David tried vainly to recall if the price he had paid the orthodontist covered everything. "Funny the things one thinks about at a time like this," David mused. "If I haven't already paid for having them removed, Jenny might be wearing these braces when she's 30. David's mind drifted back to the beach on St. John. "I promise you everything," he had said. He felt the bile rising in his throat. David looked at Ellen, still sleeping peacefully beside him. "I promised you everything," he thought, "and now I've provided nothing." Quickly, David got out of bed, stumbled into the bathroom, and threw up. Around 7, Ellen woke up alone. Putting on her housecoat and slippers, she went into the kitchen where she found her husband sitting at the breakfast table. It seemed strange to her to see him in jeans and a t-shirt. For years, David had been the first one awake in their family, and by this time, he had always been ready to walk out the door in a coat and tie. It was obvious to Ellen that he had not slept at all. "Good morning, dear," she said. "Jenny's not up yet," David said. "Coffee's made." She looked at him for a moment. "David," she said, "everything will be fine." He turned and stared out the window into the backyard. "David," she said again, "everything is going to be okay. We've been through tough times before."
"I'm 46, Ellen," David said. 46-year-old executives are not being hired anywhere except McDonald's. We have a second mortgage on this house, you know. Your car's not paid for, and I don't have one anymore. I get no severance from the plant because I didn't opt out in the package deal they offered last year. We don't have any money. I don't know where to borrow anymore. This is more than a tough time, and we have not been through this before."
"So what are we going to do?" Ellen asked.
"I don't know," David answered. "I have no clue."
Chapter 2. 7 months later, David felt like a beaten man. The health insurance coverage from his former employer had run its course, and the part-time job David took at a hardware store provided little more than minimum wage. Ellen was making more money than he was. She had placed hand-printed advertisements on bulletin boards all over town and was cleaning houses 5 days a week. Every day for months, David continued to search for a job. The seemingly endless stream of rejections confused him. "At least I'm on my way up," he kept telling himself. It can't get any worse." But it did. That morning had dawned cold and hard. It was everything David had always hated about winter. The sky was the color of dirty water, and the below-freezing temperature, carried by a nasty wind, cut David like the thrust of 1,000 knives. Struggling into the used car he had bought with a loan from his father, David cursed at nothing and at no one in particular. The car seemed to David a constant reminder of his failure. He had answered an ad in the newspaper and paid a high school kid $900 for what he had hoped would be temporary transportation. It was a 2-door Dodge Colt, mostly faded silver except for the right fender, which was black. The brake lights quit about 10 minutes after David completed the sale, and a heater had never worked in the first place. Shivering as he drove to work, David's mind was as numb as his body. Ellen had been up most of the night with Jenny. The child had suffered with a fever and a sore throat now for 3 days, and with the lack of sleep, none of them were feeling well. Jenny, however, was truly sick. It was the 5th or 6th time she had been ill this winter. David had lost count. When he had gotten out of the shower that morning, he heard Ellen hanging up the phone. "Who is that?" David asked. "It was Dr. Reed's office, David," she said. "I've got to take her in to see what's wrong. Tylenol isn't handling this." "What kind of parent am I?" David said aloud, interrupting his reverie as he pulled the Colt into a parking place behind Marshall's Hardware. "What kind of person am I? What has happened to me?" When Ellen mentioned the doctor, he blew up. "Where did she think the money was coming from?" he yelled. And of course she yelled right back that she'd steal it if she had to. "This was their daughter," she shouted. "Didn't he care about that anymore?" As David left the house, he went by Jenny's room to kiss her goodbye. She had big tears rolling down her face. Jenny had heard everything. About 10 that morning, David was loading shingles on a flatbed truck in front of the store. He was grateful for the activity. The shingles were heavy, and they gave him somewhere to focus his anger.
"Ponder!"
someone yelled. David looked up. It was Mr. Marshall, the owner of the store. A tall, lanky old man with curly white hair and a red nose, he was leaning out the back door, motioning to David.
"Phone call!"
he barked as David strode past him into the warm store.
"It's your wife. Make it quick. I've told you about personal calls."
"Ellen," David said as he picked up the phone, "where are you?"
"I'm at home," she said. "We just got back from the doctor."
"What did he say?"
"David, it's her tonsils."
"Okay."
Ellen paused.
"Honey, Dr. Reed said her tonsils have to come out. He said we need to have it done right away."
"Ponder!"
David looked around. It was Mr. Marshall.
"Let's go, son," he said. "I got a driver waiting on you."
"David, are you there?"
he heard Ellen ask through the phone.
"Yes, yes, I'm here," he said. "Ellen, we have no insurance." "I've already checked," she answered. "The operation, including the hospital, will only cost $1,100.
David was stunned.
"We don't have $1,100, he said. "We can put it on a credit card."
"Hey, Ponder, this is the last time I'm going to tell you. Get off the phone,"
the store owner warned.
David put his hand over his ear, trying to concentrate on the conversation with his wife. "We don't have any room on a credit card, Ellen. Every card is maxed out." Ellen started to cry. "Then we'll just have to borrow the money, David. Jenny is sick." "I know Jenny's sick, honey, but we can't borrow anything. We're a month behind on the house, 2 months on your car. No bank will touch us. My parents don't have any more money to loan, and God knows yours don't. With your dad's lawn business, they struggle through the winter just to make it themselves." Ellen could hardly talk through her tears. "Oh, David, what are we going to do?" "Don't worry," he said. "I'll get the money somehow. Maybe I can work overtime here. Or maybe I can get an advance. I'll get the money." As Ellen continued to cry, David pleaded with her. "Honey, please calm down. I have to go. I'll take care of this. I promise. I love you." He hung up the phone. Turning to move from behind the counter, David met Mr. Marshall face to face. "I'm sorry," he started to say, but the old man cut him off.
"Your next job, you need to pay attention to the rules," Marshall said.
David was confused. "Excuse me?" he asked.
"You can come back on Friday, and your check will be waiting. I'm letting you go."
I'm fired?" David stammered. "I'm fired because I used the telephone?" Marshall stood there with his arms crossed. "My daughter is sick." The old man didn't say a word. David was incredulous. He pointed at the phone. "That was my wife calling because my daughter's sick." David paused, then said once more, this time in almost a whisper, "My daughter is sick." Raising and lowering his hands in a helpless gesture and shaking his head, David turned and walked slowly out the door. Reaching the car, David fumbled for the keys and laughed. He had experienced a brief mental flash of the car not starting. "Mr. Marshall," he saw himself saying, "my car won't start. May I use your phone?" Twisting the key in the ignition, David laughed again as the car roared to life. "Obviously," he thought, "I'm laughing because I'm cracking up." As David wheeled out of the hardware store parking lot, he wondered, "If I'm sane enough to recognize insanity, does that mean I'm okay after all?" He laughed again. This time he actually laughed until he cried. Out on the interstate, David drove past the exit for home. Traffic was light, and it was only 11:15. No reason to go home and share the big news with Ellen just yet. Ellen doesn't deserve this, David thought. And Jenny certainly did not choose me for a father. A year ago, I was on top of the world, and now I can't even provide for my family. David pulled onto the shoulder. Bowing his head, he clasped his hands together. "Oh, God," he said aloud. "Oh, God." He stopped and was silent for almost a minute. "Oh, God," he began again. After another minute, he put the Colt into gear and moved back out onto the highway. "I can't even pray," he thought. On an impulse, David took the Grayton exit. Almost 40 miles from home, he was driving to nowhere in particular. "Just like my life," he thought, "going nowhere in particular, nowhere special. Didn't I used to think I had a purpose?" David wondered. "Wasn't I accomplishing something?" David looked at the speedometer. It read 70. There were no other vehicles anywhere in sight. He pressed harder on the accelerator. 80. 85. As he flew over hills and around curves, David became oblivious to the speed. 90 miles per hour. His thoughts were also racing at a furious pace. Ellen was still young. She was beautiful. If he weren't around, she could find someone else to take better care of her and Jenny. "I still have life insurance," he thought. "Would they be better off without me? Would everyone be better off without me?" Without any further conscious thought, David jammed his foot on the accelerator, pressing it down to the floorboard. The little car screamed as David gripped the steering wheel, trying to drive away from his life. With tears streaming down his face, he rolled the window down and steered into a straightaway. The freezing wind seemed to clarify his thoughts. "Why am I here?" David said aloud. Why is everything happening to me?" He pounded his hand on the steering wheel, let his foot off the accelerator for a second, then stomped it to the floor again. "Why me?" he screamed. "Why me?" At that instant, David's moment of despair intersected with an icy bridge. Covering a small stream, the bridge was no more than 50 feet long, but its sheet of black ice sent the speeding car careening into a spin.
Tires screeching, David's car bounced off the guardrail as he crossed the short bridge and found himself still on the highway. He fought desperately for control as the car fishtailed from side to side and finally swerved off the road. Many people, when faced with a life-or-death crisis, talk of seeing their past scroll before their eyes. They experience childhood, adolescence, and many years of living all in one split second. In that moment, one person might feel remorse, while another gains an acceptance of the inevitable and receives a peaceful calm. David Ponder, on the other hand, had only questions in his heart as his car careened helplessly toward a giant oak tree. With his remaining conscious thought, David removed his hands from the steering wheel and raised them as fists to the sky. "Please, God," he cried. "Why me?" And then, nothing. Chapter 3.
"Please get off the floor and sit in this chair."
Slowly, David opened his eyes and looked directly into the face of a man who seemed vaguely familiar. A small, older gentleman, his short, almost white hair was neatly combed, contrasting with the slightly disheveled appearance of his clothes. The sleeves of his dress shirt were rolled up at the elbows, and his red and black striped tie was loosened at the collar. Atop his sharp nose sat a pair of round spectacles that were thick enough to make his clear blue eyes seem huge.
"This is a very inconvenient time for me," the man said. "Just sit right there and be very quiet."
Turning quickly, he walked toward a huge hand-carved desk. Settling himself behind it and picking up a stack of papers, he grumbled,
"As if I don't have enough happening right now."
Confused, David glanced around. He was sitting on a large Persian rug, his back against the wall of an ornate, high-ceilinged room. Directly to his left was the hard-backed mahogany chair that had been indicated by the man who was now intently sorting papers across the room. To his right, a globe stood on a pedestal in front of an unlit fireplace. Easing up and into the chair, David said, "I'm thirsty." Without looking up, the man replied,
"I'll get you something in a bit. For now, please be quiet."
"Where am I?" David asked.
"Look here now,"
the man cursed as he slammed the stack of papers down on his desk and pointed a finger at David.
"I politely ask you to be quiet, and I'm expecting you to do it. You're in Potsdam, Germany, a suburb of Berlin in a free zone presently controlled by the Red Army. It is Tuesday, July 24th, 1945.
Taking a deep breath and appearing to calm down, he reached for his work again. Separating the papers, he said,
"There now, sit and chew on that for a while."
David wrinkled his brow. "I must be in a hospital," he thought. "This is a creepy old place. And if this guy's my doctor, he has a horrible bedside manner." Sitting absolutely still, trying to collect himself, David watched the man at the desk. "Why would he tell me I'm in Germany?" he wondered. "And the Red Army thing? I must have a head injury. Is this some kind of psychiatric exam?" He tugged at the collar of his dark blue sweatshirt. Uncomfortably warm, David noticed a water pitcher and some glasses on a small table near the window, directly across the room. He stood up and walked slowly to the water. From the corner of his eye, David saw the man behind the desk briefly glance up, frown, and go back to his work. David quietly poured a glass of water and, drinking it, looked out the window. He was obviously in a second-floor room of this building or house or whatever it was. Below him, no more than 50 feet away, was the bank of a slow-moving river. There were no people boating, no children playing. In fact, he didn't see anyone at all. "Something isn't right here," David muttered as a breeze crossed his face and rustled the drapes beside him. Reaching his arm through the open window, David was almost startled to find that the air was warm and humid. Then he realized what had been bothering him. It was the air itself. The air was warm. Every tree within sight was full of leaves, and the grass in the yard below him was green. In the dead of winter? Putting his glass down on the table, David placed his hands on the windowsill and pushed his whole upper body through the opening. Yes. It was hot, he decided, and pulled himself back inside. What kind of place is this? David wondered. Why are the windows open in the first place? As hot as it is, the air conditioning should be running full blast. As he moved back toward his seat, David looked around for a thermostat. There wasn't one that he could see. The only temperature-controlling device was an old heater that someone had put in the fireplace. Not that that heater would do anyone any good, he thought. It's so old, it looks like it could have been made in... David stopped in mid-stride. In a soft voice, he said aloud, 1945. Wheeling suddenly, David faced the man behind the desk. The white-haired gentleman looked up and slowly pushed his work to the side. A slight smile on his thin lips, he leaned back into his chair, crossed his arms, and peered curiously at David. David's mind raced furiously. Potsdam. Potsdam, he thought. Why is that name so familiar? Then, like a thunderbolt, it came to him. Potsdam, Germany, he remembered from a television documentary, was the site of the famous war conference after which the decision had been made to drop the atomic bomb on Japan during World War II. A shudder passed through his body as David put his hands to his head. Think, think, he commanded himself. Who attended the war conference in Potsdam? It was Churchill, Stalin, and... All the breath seemed to go out of David at once as he groped for the chair behind him. Sitting down heavily, he stared at the man in front of him. You're Harry Truman, he said in a shocked tone.
Yes, the man said. I am. Though at the moment I'd give anything to be almost anyone else.
Swallowing audibly, David said, They call you Give-'em-Hell Harry. Truman grimaced.
I never give anybody hell, he snorted. I just tell the truth, and they think it's hell.
Removing his glasses, he rubbed his eyes and said,
Obviously, I'll not be getting any peace from this point on, so we might as well go ahead and talk.
Putting his glasses back on, he rose and came out from behind the desk.
By the way, he said, Why not you?
Excuse me? David asked.
Why not you?
Looking directly into David's eyes, he enunciated the words carefully, separating them as if he were speaking to a child.
I believe that's the answer to the last question you asked before you arrived.
David frowned. Trying to remember, he said, I was in an accident, I think.
Yes, Truman said. That's sometimes how this happens. And the last question a person asked is often, why me? Of course, why me is a question great men and women have been asking themselves since time began. I know the thought has occurred to me more than once during the past few days. It's hard for me to believe that 25 years ago I was a clerk in a clothing store.
Truman extended his hand and pulled David to his feet.
What's your name, son?
David Ponder. Am I okay?
Well, David Ponder, if you mean am I dead, the answer is no. If you simply mean am I okay,
Truman shrugged.
I'm not so sure. I've never been given any information on how these things turn out.
Suddenly, David relaxed. Smiling, he said, I understand. I'm dreaming, right?
Maybe you are, the president said. But, David, I'm not. And even if you are dreaming, that's not a problem. For centuries, dreams have been used to communicate instruction and direction to people of purpose, great men and women. God used dreams to prepare Joseph for his future as a leader of nations. He gave battle plans to Gideon in a dream. Joan of Arc, Jacob, George Washington, Marie Curie, and the Apostle Paul were all guided by their dreams.
But I'm an ordinary guy, David said. I'm nothing like any of the people you've mentioned. Great, I mean, and I'm certainly no Apostle Paul. I'm not even sure I believe in God anymore. Truman smiled as he put a hand on David's shoulder.
That's all right, son, he said. He believes in you.
How can you be certain of that? David asked.
Because, Truman responded, you wouldn't be here if he didn't. Occasionally, someone is chosen to travel the ages, gathering wisdom for future generations. It's as if the Almighty literally reaches down and places his hand on a shoulder, and in this particular case, the president peered over his glasses, it was your shoulder.
A sharp knock at the door drew their attention. Without waiting for response, a large, stocky man strode into the room. It was Fred Canfill, Truman's special bodyguard. Formerly the U.S. Marshal from Kansas City, Fred was temporarily attached to the Secret Service and had become a favorite of the president and his family.
I'm sorry to barge in on you like this, sir,
he said, as his eyes surveyed the room. I thought I heard you talking to someone. No, Fred, Truman said as he looked directly at David. No one here.
Then, motioning toward the door with his hands, he said,
If you'll see that I'm not disturbed.
Of course, Mr. President,
Canfield said as he slowly backed out, a concerned look on his face. Still glancing about, he added,
I'll be escorting you to the conference room within the hour, but if you need me before then, you'll be right outside, Truman said as he ushered his bewildered friend from the room, and I won't hesitate to call for you. Thank you, Fred.
As the president closed the door, David asked, He can't see me?
Apparently no one can, Truman replied. No one, that is, except the person you came to visit. Of course, that makes me look a little crazy, he said with a grin, in here, all alone, talking to myself.
Quickly, he wiped the grin off his face and continued,
But I shouldn't think anyone should find it strange. I have ample reason to be talking to myself, what with everything going on here.
Truman cocked his head and looked at David from the corner of his eye.
It is curious how you people always seem to show up during critical points in my life.
So this has happened to you before? David asked.
Yes, Truman said. 3 times now since I became president, you being the third. The first time was the night Roosevelt died. I was all alone in the Oval Office, and this kid just appeared out of nowhere. Fred came busting through the door, almost gave me a heart attack. It was strange. No one could see him but me.
The kid?
Yeah, the kid.
Truman paused.
I say kid. He was a teenager, actually. He was having trouble deciding whether or not to finish college.
David was incredulous. That doesn't seem to be a problem big enough for the president.
What are you here for? Truman asked.
I don't know.
Well, the president said as he moved across the room, at least the kid had a question.
Leaning against the desk, he motioned for David to sit in a chair near the globe.
Anyway, there was a lot of pressure for him to stay in school.
What did you tell him to do? David asked.
I didn't tell him to do anything, Truman replied. That's not my part in all this. I offer perspective. The ultimate outcome of anyone's life is a matter of personal choice, the president continued. I was evidently his second visit. He had just spent an hour or so with Albert Einstein.
David shifted uncomfortably in his seat. Will I be going somewhere after this?
Yes, you will, Truman said. Several places, actually, but don't worry. They will be expecting you.
So you knew I was coming?
I was informed, as you might expect, in a dream, the other evening, Truman said.
Walking around behind his desk, Truman opened the right top drawer. Removing a folded piece of paper, he handed it to David and said,
I was instructed to prepare this for you. This is the essence of why you're here. It is one of the decisions for success. This is the first of 7 you will receive. You are to keep it with you, reading it twice daily until it is committed to your heart. For only by committing this principle to your heart will you be able to share its value with others.
David started to unfold the page.
No, no, the president said as he put his hands over David's. Don't read it now. You must wait until our meeting is finished. As soon as you read those words, you will immediately travel to your next destination. Amazing, actually. You read the last word and bang, you're gone.
David reached over and touched the globe, unconsciously turning it to the United States. Do you know my future? He asked.
Nope, Truman said. Can't help you there, and wouldn't if I could. Your future is what you decide it will be. Now you, on the other hand, could probably tell me mine.
As David opened his mouth to speak, the president held out his hands as if to ward off the words.
Thanks, but no thanks. God knows there are enough influences coming to bear without you telling me what I already did.
You say my future is what I decide it to be, David ventured. I'm not sure I agree with that. My present is certainly not of my making. I worked for years to finally end up with no job, no money, and no prospects.
David? We are all in situations of our own choosing. Our thinking creates a pathway to success or failure. By disclaiming responsibility for our present, we crush the prospect of an incredible future that might have been ours.
I don't understand, David said.
I'm saying that outside influences are not responsible for where you are mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, or financially. You have chosen the pathway to your present destination. The responsibility for your situation is yours.
David stood up. That's not true, he cried angrily. I did a good job at the plant. I could have taken early retirement, but I stayed. I stayed to help the company remain afloat, and I was fired. It was not my fault.
Sit down, Truman said softly.
Drawing a chair around to face David, who was trembling with anger and confusion, he said,
Look here, son. It's not my desire to upset you, but with the limited time we've been given together, truth will have to stand before tact.
Placing his elbows on his knees, the president leaned forward and took a deep breath.
Listen to me now. You are where you are because of your thinking. Your thinking dictates your decisions. Decisions are choices. Years ago, you chose where you would attend college. You chose your course of study. When you graduated with the degree you chose to pursue, you chose the companies to which you would send a resume. After interviewing with the companies that responded, you chose the one for which you would work. Somewhere during that time, you chose to go to a party or a play or a ball game. There you met a girl whom you chose to marry. Together you chose to have a family and how large that family would be. When you chose the house in which you would live and the cars you would drive, you chose how much the payments would be each month. By choosing to eat ribeye steaks or hot dogs, you chose your household expenses. And you were the one who chose not to take early retirement. You chose to stay until the bitter end. Years ago, you began making the choices that led you to your present situation, and you walked right down the middle of the path every step of the way.
Truman paused. He pulled out his handkerchief and wiped his brow. David's head was hanging, his chin on his chest.
David, look at me, the president said.
David's eyes met his.
The words, it's not my fault, should never again come from your mouth. The words, it's not my fault, have been symbolically written on the gravestones of unsuccessful people ever since Eve took her first bite of the apple. Until a person takes responsibility for where he is, there is no basis for moving on. The bad news is the past was in your hands. But the good news is that the future, my friend, is also in your hands.
As the president leaned forward to touch the younger man on the shoulder, he was interrupted by three quick knocks on the door.
Mr. President,
came a voice from the hallway. It was Fred Canfield.
5-minute warning, sir. I'll wait for you out here. Mr. Churchill and the Russian are already making their way to the conference room.
Thank you, Fred,
Truman chuckled.
It seems my bodyguard doesn't care very much for Mr. Stalin. Come to think of it, neither do I. And frankly, I keep a few of my plans to myself, but I suppose he's a necessary part of this process.
He stood up and began rolling down his sleeves and buttoning the cuffs. David saw the president's jacket hanging over the back of the desk chair and went to retrieve it. What will you do? He asked. Truman buttoned his collar, straightened his tie, and eyed David warily.
Let's not play any games here, son. I think we both know what I'm about to do. Do I want to do it? Do I want to deploy this bomb? Of course not.
He strode to his desk and gathered several notebooks. Suddenly he put them down again and faced David.
I don't have any idea what you know about me.
He paused.
I suppose I mean that I don't know what people say about me in the
he wiggled his left hand at David as if he could conjure up the words he wanted to say.
I don't know what they say about me where you come from. For all I know, history books are all full of how I feel or how I look or what kind of scotch I drink, and frankly, I don't care. But let's get something straight between you and me. I hate this weapon, okay? I'm scared of it. And I'm concerned about what it might mean for the future of our world.
Why have you decided to use it? David asked the question with no accusation, no judgment in the tone of his voice. He simply wanted to understand the thoughts of this common man who had been placed in an uncommon position.
Why have you decided to drop the bomb? Truman took a deep breath.
I am the first president since the beginning of modern warfare to have experienced combat. During the First World War, I would have given anything, paid any price to end the death and suffering I watched my friends endure. And now, here I sit, the commander-in-chief, with the ability, no, the responsibility, to end this war and bring our boys home. Believe me, he said as he slipped on his jacket, I have examined every option. I asked General Marshall what it would cost in lives to land on the Tokyo plain and other places in Japan. It was his opinion that such an invasion would cost at a minimum 250,000 American lives. And that's just the invasion. After that, we would literally be forced to go house to house and take the country. Did you know that during this whole war, not one single Japanese platoon has surrendered? Not one?
David watched Truman, his jaw set, but with a weariness in his face as he placed the final papers in a leather satchel.
Yes, he said. It must be done. How could any president face the mothers and sons and daughters of these American servicemen if after the slaughter of an invasion of Japan it became known that there was within the arsenal a weapon of sufficient force to end the war, and it was not used?
He stared blankly at David for a moment. It was as if he were seeing something of his own future, and it scared him. Shaking his head to clear his thoughts, he said,
"Still got the paper?"
"Yes, sir," David said as he held up the folded page that had never left his hand.
"Well, then," the president said with a smile, "go ahead and read it."
He walked to the door, opened it, and was about to walk through when he paused, turned, and said,
"David?"
"Sir," David answered.
"Good luck, son."
"Thank you, sir," David said. Truman turned to leave, but again reached back in to shake David's hand.
"And one more thing," he said as he raised an eyebrow. "Just because I use the expression good luck doesn't mean that luck actually has anything to do with where you end up."
With that, the President of the United States closed the door. All alone, David glanced around the room. He walked slowly to the desk and sat down behind it in the big leather chair where Truman had been only moments before. Carefully, he unfolded the paper and began to read. The First Decision for Success. The buck stops here. From this moment forward, I will accept responsibility for my past. I understand that the beginning of wisdom is to accept the responsibility for my own problems, and that by accepting responsibility for my past, I free myself to move into a bigger, brighter future of my own choosing. Never again will I blame my parents, my spouse, my boss, or other employees for my present situation. Neither my education nor lack of one, my genetics, or the circumstantial ebb and flow of everyday life will affect my future in a negative way. If I allow myself to blame these uncontrollable forces for my lack of success, I will be forever caught in a web of the past. I will look forward. I will not let my history control my destiny. The buck stops here. I accept responsibility for my past. I am responsible for my success. I am where I am today, mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, and financially, because of decisions I have made. My decisions have always been governed by my thinking. Therefore, I am where I am today, mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, and financially, because of how I think. Today, I will begin the process of changing where I am, mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally, and financially, by changing the way I think. My thoughts will be constructive, never destructive. My mind will live in the solutions of the future. It will not dwell in the problems of the past. I will seek the association of those who are working and striving to bring about positive changes in the world. I will never seek comfort by associating with those who have decided to be comfortable. When faced with the opportunity to make a decision, I will make one. I understand that God did not put in me the ability to always make right decisions. He did, however, put in me the ability to make a decision, then make it right. The rise and fall of my emotional tide will not deter me from my course. When I make a decision, I will stand behind it. My energy will go into making the decision. I will waste none on second thoughts. My life will not be an apology. It will be a statement. The buck stops here. I control my thoughts. I control my emotions. In the future, when I am tempted to ask the question, why me? I will immediately counter with the answer, why not me? Challenges are gifts, opportunities to learn. Problems are the common thread running through the lives of great men and women. In times of adversity, I will not have a problem to deal with. I will have a choice to make. My thoughts will be clear. I will make the right choice. Adversity is preparation for greatness. I will accept this preparation. Why me? Why not me? I will be prepared for something great. I accept responsibility for my past. I control my thoughts. I control my emotions. I am responsible for my success. The buck stops here. Chapter 4. As David read the final words on the page, he looked up. The office turned and seemed to shift, the edges of the room lower than its center. The desk, which had been right in front of him, appeared to stretch and curve. Standing, he pushed the chair away and stepped toward the window. He never made it. Suddenly dizzy, David felt his knees buckle, and his forward motion sent him face first to the floor. Reaching out to catch himself, David was somehow not surprised to see his hands continue through the Persian rug as if it were not there. His head, body, and legs followed into darkness. Almost instantly, as if he had fallen through the floor into a room below, David was on his feet, alert and unharmed. He stood in a large room that was more than 100 feet long, 50 feet wide, with a ceiling close to 50 feet high. He was caught in the middle of a group of people who were actively jostling for position in order to see a disturbance occurring somewhere to the front. The men, he could see, were bare-chested and tanned deeply from the sun. Women wore robes of brightly colored cloth, and their hair, rolled into ropes and twisted down their backs, was extremely long. Moving with the crowd, David breathed deeply. The air smelled strongly of cedar. He noted with amazement that the walls and huge columns supporting the roof were crafted entirely from the pungent wood. The floor was fitted with massive slabs of gray, almost purple marble. Without warning, a gong was struck. The sound was ear-shattering. Immediately, every man and woman around David ceased talking, fell to their knees, and lowered their heads. David, too stunned to do anything but stand there, suddenly had a clear view of the room. Directly in front of him were six steps. On each side of the steps were statues of lions. Carved from dark marble, each was a masterpiece. They paled in comparison, however, to the side at the top of the steps. Standing alone in the center of a granite pedestal was a throne made of ivory and detailed in pure gold. The back of the elaborate chair was rounded at the top and had armrests on each side. Two more lions, these made of gold, stood silent watch beside the throne. The gong sounded again. This time, a man near the throne walked quickly to a curtain behind it and parted the cloth. Stepping through the open space was the most radiant human being David had ever seen. He wore a robe of brilliant turquoise. Rubies and gems of every sort were sewn into the hems and sleeves of the garment. Around his arms and neck were bands of solid gold. The crown on his head, also made of gold, was dusted with small diamonds. David was open-mouthed, the only person in the room still standing, staring openly at this awe-inspiring figure. He was a large man. In his sandaled feet, he appeared to be slightly taller than David. His thick, dark hair was shoulder-length, parted in the middle, and seemed to be held in place by the heavy crown. Circling to the front of the throne, he sat down and said simply, "Let us begin." Immediately the crowd leaped to its feet, and the disturbance began again near the throne. As he maneuvered to a better vantage point in order to see, David could hear the angry voices of two women. "He is mine!" one of them screamed. "No, no!" cried the other. "You are a thief!" David eased his way to the front as the crowd started to become unruly, taking sides with the two women and shouting insults.
"Silence!"
the man on the throne said forcefully, and at once a hush passed over the people. David moved to the edge of the steps. He was in plain view of the two women and the throne above them. As of yet, no one had acknowledged his presence. He felt utterly invisible. Seeing the women clearly for the first time, David noticed that one of them held a newborn baby. Every person in the room had his eyes directed toward the throne. David felt as if he were the only one breathing. Then, with a gesture of his hand, the man indicated the second woman, the woman standing alone, and said softly, "Tell me your story." The woman bowed and said,
"Your Majesty, this woman and I live in the same house. Not long ago, my baby was born at home. 3 days later, her baby was born. No one was with us. Last night, while we were all asleep, she rolled over on her baby, and he died. Then, while I was still asleep, she got up and took my son out of my bed and put it in her own. Then she put her dead baby next to me."
There was murmuring through the crowd as she continued,
"In the morning, when I arose to feed my son, I saw that he was dead. Then I looked at him in the light, and I knew he was not my son." "No!" the other woman shouted. "He was your son! My child is alive!" "The dead baby is yours!" yelled the woman who told the story. "You are holding my child! My baby is alive!"
David watched the women argue back and forth until the king raised his hand and silenced them all again. Carefully, the king looked into the eyes of each woman. In a measured tone, he commanded an attendant, "Bring me my sword." David stood transfixed as the sword was brought from behind the curtain. It was very nearly 5 feet long, gleaming silver with a golden handle. Emeralds decorated the lower part of the shaft. The king took it in his hand, stood up, and said,
"Bring the baby to me. I will cut him in half. That way each of you can have a part of him."
He raised the sword as if to strike.
"Please don't kill my son!" screamed the woman standing alone. "Your Majesty, give him to her! Give him to her, but don't kill him! Go ahead and cut him in half!"
the other woman snarled as she pushed the child toward the king. "Then neither of us will have the baby."
The king said softly,
"I won't harm the baby. I never intended to."
He pointed to the woman who was on her knees, weeping.
"Give the child to her," he said. "She is his real mother."
As the woman's tears of anguish turned into tears of joy, the baby was placed in her arms and the crowd cheered. David yelled and clapped right along with them. When the king rose from his throne, the people knelt to the ground once more, leaving David standing alone. As the king moved behind the throne toward the curtain, he paused, turned, and looked directly at David, as if to say, "Are you coming?" David caught the look and quickly followed him up the steps and behind the throne. Passing through the curtains, he entered a smaller but more fabulous room. Gold shields crossed with silver spears lined the walls. Pillows of linen and tanned skins were scattered in the corner near a low table, covered with food of every description. Light entered the room through high windows embellished with ivory and gold. David came fully into the center of the room. The two attendants guarding the door did not notice him, but the king, who was speaking to another man near the table, saw David and finished his conversation.
"As you wish, Ahijar," David heard him say. "I am certain you, as Prime Minister, will make the correct decision."
He moved to recline on the pillows at the table.
"Please go now, and instruct all the attendants to leave the hall."
The man called Ahijar was shocked.
"But, Your Majesty," he said, "it is not safe to—"
"I prefer to be alone," the king interrupted. "Thank you for your concern, but at this time, it is unnecessary. Now go, Ahijar."
Bowing as he left, the Prime Minister exited and motioned the attendants out after him. Alone at last, David and the king stared curiously at each other. The king spoke first.
"Do you know where you are?"
he asked with a smile. "Yes, sir," David answered hesitantly.
"Do you know who I am?"
"Yes, sir, I do." This time David answered the question more confidently. "You are King Solomon, sir. I recognize the story." Solomon furrowed his brow.
I mean, I recognized what happened out there.
David motioned toward the curtain.
What I'm trying to say is that I remember the story from when I was a child.
Solomon smiled, amused at David's confusion.
No matter, he said. Are you hungry?
Yes, sir, David replied.
Then please, join me.
Solomon pointed to an especially big pillow on which David promptly sat.
You see before you the finest food available anywhere in the world. The food and anything else you might need is yours for the asking.
Thank you, David said as he reached for some fruit. By the way, my name is David Ponder.
Two names, Solomon noted with interest. Incidentally, you speak my language well. Have you been schooled in Hebrew, or is your tongue also a surprise?
Actually, David said as he opened a pomegranate, I was startled to find that I understood every word being spoken when I arrived. I'm even more amazed that I'm able to talk with you now. I never even learned Spanish, and here I am speaking effortlessly in an ancient language.
Solomon chuckled. The dialect is not so ancient to me, my friend, but I do understand your astonishment. Wherever you travel on this unusual journey, you will find that your mouth and ear have been granted a special ability to communicate and comprehend. This unique competence in other languages is, of course, critical to your understanding and application of the gift with which you are being entrusted.
A gift? David asked.
The scrolls, Solomon answered. I prepared this one for you only this morning.
He gently placed his hand on a thin piece of leather that had been tightly wound around a small wooden rod.
It is the message that was placed in my heart for you. This is merely a part of what must be ingrained in your life before you will be able to pass the gift to others.
How am I supposed to pass this gift to anyone? David asked, shaking his head. The king smiled slightly as he reached for a bunch of grapes. Plucking one from its stem, he placed it in his mouth and said thoughtfully,
That is something you may not know for yet some time. Then again, the answer could be revealed to you tomorrow. Jehovah moves mountains to create the opportunity of his choosing. It is up to you to be ready to move yourself.
David leaned forward. I think I understand what you're saying. You mean I have to prepare for whatever's in store? Solomon nodded slowly.
Then here's a question, David said almost sarcastically. How do I prepare for something when I don't know, A, what it is, or B, when it will happen?
Solomon was quiet.
Sir?
David said a bit louder. He was becoming exasperated. Look, he began again.
I'm serious. How do I prepare for an uncertain future?
Seek wisdom, the king said simply. David came close to rolling his eyes.
Maybe I'm not too smart, he said, but I'm just not catching on here. Okay, let me ask you this. How do I seek wisdom?
The answer I have for you will not quell your frustration with me, the king replied and then paused.
My answer is to seek wisdom.
David's mouth dropped open. He shook his head and was about to speak when Solomon interrupted.
David, he said, you have a condition common to most people. You hear, but you do not listen. Seek wisdom. Seek wisdom. Wisdom waits to be gathered. She cannot be bartered or sold. She is a gift for the diligent, and only the diligent will find her. The lazy man, the stupid man, he never even looks. Though wisdom is available to many, she is found by few. Seek wisdom. Find her, and you will find success and contentment.
Well, David said, I certainly don't have success or contentment in my life right now.
All a part of the past, Solomon noted. Even the present is constantly becoming the past, now, and now, and now.
He snapped his fingers as he talked.
The past will never change, but you can change the future by changing your actions today. It is really a very simple process. We as humans are always in a process of change. Therefore, we might as well guide the direction in which we change.
How do I guide that direction? David asked. Solomon rose to his feet and began to walk around the room. Clasping his hands behind his back, he asked,
Do you have a child?
Yes, I do, David answered. A 12-year-old daughter. The king said,
Are you concerned about the children with whom your daughter plays?
Yes, David replied. Of course.
Solomon turned quickly and said,
You say of course. Why?